One of the things when I think about this line here, which is kind of starting at the end, is something we call ethos. In other words, no preacher or preaching is as effectual as it must be if the preacher or his preaching lacks ethos. What do we mean by ethos? Well, let me open this thing with a picture. You'll kind of realize I'm generally thinking about art. Hopefully you can kind of call out when you think you know what this is. Yeah, those are the Chuck Taylor All-Stars. Kind of a heavy-footed shoe, though, that one there. It's a little better than that, isn't it? My dad was a basketball coach, pretty good one at that. He just got awarded this last year the Tex Winter Assistant Coach of the NBA Lifetime Achievement Award. It's only been given to 5 coaches. They have to be an assistant, but I call it the Assistant Coach Hall of Fame. And my dad grew me up in the locker room, and I still remember my first pair of Chuck Taylors. I mean, the smell of the rubber, opening that big tongue up and putting your nose just in there, the canvas, seeing that Chuck Taylor seal. I have vivid, almost palpable memories of decades of my life given to the sound of the squeaking on the hardwood floor. Nothing better for me than a 90-degree day in Chicago with humidity at 90, playing all day in an indoor gym at 105 degrees. To me, that was growing up. Why do I give this picture for ethos? Well, Chuck Taylor's shoes, they came out, they were really the official shoe in about 1968. They were the only shoe. I call it, this is the platonic shoe upon which all other basketball shoes were built. This is the one in the sky that everybody came after. What am I telling you? This emblem, this picture is for me a symbol of the genuine article. This is the original. This is the authentic one. That's what ethos is. Ethos is the indispensable characteristic of authenticity. And in a world of imitations, the genuine article is really what matters. So if you want to be a preacher, there's something about you that your preparation must begin with. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the need for you and me, not just in a weekly sermon preparation, but in a preparation of our life and in preparation of our ministry, where we are cultivating ethos in the preacher and in the preaching. I want to read a little bit about what Aristotle said about this. I'm moving from the picture to what I call the principle. This is what Aristotle said about ethos. Since the object of rhetoric, now just don't get lost, rhetoric to him was persuasive speaking. The object of speaking, which as a preacher, you're trying to persuade your listeners to make a judgment on something. Since the object of rhetoric is judgment, it's not only necessary to consider how to make the speech itself demonstrative and convincing, but also that the speaker should show himself to be of a certain character and how to know that he can put the judge in a certain frame of mind. So this character is what's at play. What did he mean by this? Aristotle goes on and says, the speaker should show himself to be possessed of certain qualities, and that his hearers should think that he is disposed in a certain way toward them, and therefore them toward him. You're not going to get very far if they're not ready to hear you and you're not ready to understand them. This exchange has to take place in speaking. Qualities, he says. Why don't you talk to the guy next to you? What qualities must the speaker have within himself to demonstrate credibility? Just go for it. See if we can get a few things up here. All right, let's just get a few. Anybody? Did I hear the word integrity? Did somebody say that? Okay, integrity. What do you mean by it?
Has to be trustworthy.
Trustworthy. Somebody else? Qualities.
Humility.
Humility. Honesty.
Passion.
Passion.
Experience.
Experience. Yeah, I remember once when I first went into ministry, you know, I got converted at age, eight, just before I turned 18, and started preaching right away. By about 23, I was pastoring, and I still remember meeting a lady in the church. They were talking about John F. Kennedy's assassination. She said, "Where were you when Kennedy was assassinated?" I said, "Well, I was like 3 years old." She said, "Anybody who doesn't know where they were when Kennedy is assassinated is too young to be my preacher." Right. Yeah, people want experience. Life experience actually helps credibility. It's what's difficult when you're starting out in ministry, which makes those early years really important. Interestingly, the rhetoricians of ancient Greco-Roman world like Aristotle and Cicero, they came up with three things. They boiled it down this way. These are the three qualities they talk about. And some of the things you've mentioned are inherent in them. Good sense, virtue, and goodwill. That you have to possess these. And you have to demonstrate in the preaching that these things are possessed. Not just in your character, but even through your sermon work, as it were, as we look at it. So what did they mean by good sense? They really meant that you could form good opinions, that what you were saying was rational, reasonable. They would have taken a little bit of issue with us on passion, because for us, passion demonstrates authenticity. But for them, passion would have made them a little suspect, and you're going to have to actually win your way over that word to be found credible by some. We probably still have that today in some corners. But good sense. Is what you're saying actually reasonable, rational? Is it organized well? Yep, you know, that's going to be important. Virtue. Virtue really is that, rather than being vicious, you actually in your heart have their well-being in play. And people can know this. Unfortunately, this week I was preaching a sermon and I had this sense on virtue at war in me because there were a couple things I wanted to say to a few people. You know, you ever get that? You're like, man, I'm ready to lay this down on a few folks. But in my heart, it wasn't really squared up with, it was a little vicious. I didn't really have their well-being at heart. And my only way to fight through it was I had to wait in my spirit until I was able to identify some of the things within me that I saw within them. So in the preaching, I was able to say, you know, let me tell you about my journey in Christian life. I mean, early on, I had the gift of annihilation in Jesus' name, you know. And until I actually was there, I don't think someone would have heard me because I didn't have their well-being in play. I just wanted to lay it out there. And they can pick up on it. They pick up on it when you're not actually virtuous. And then goodwill, which really they really felt meant that you wouldn't withhold something from them that was good for them, even if it was hard for them to hear. Do you have goodwill? Are you willing to, in one sense, say the truth, the whole truth, with the conviction that needs to be there? Goodwill, virtue, good sense. We'll come back to that in a bit. I just want to go to one final thing from Aristotle and then have you talk about this. This is what he finally says. If you have these things in yourself and in your preaching, he says, quote, "The speaker who appears to possess all three will necessarily convince his hearers." In other words, you'll win the day. Your preaching will be effective, relevant, useful, helpful. Let me repeat the sentence, and then I want you to talk to the guy next to you about the difference between rhetoric in an ancient world and preaching in our world. Here's the line, because there's a bit of it that makes me a little uncomfortable as much as I like most of it. He says, "The speaker who appears to possess all three will necessarily convince his hearers." What about that raises a yellow flag of caution for us and our work? Talk to the guy next to you. All right, anybody? What appears? Is that what you said? Yeah, the word appears. Is that how you spell appears? Appears, appear. That's right. One, two P's. Yeah. Hey, you just need to know I was a 1.9 GPA. All you needed in college was a 1.9, and you were eligible to play. That was beautiful. There was no value in rising above 1.9. You never wanted to fall below 1.9. I remember going into Mrs. All's class every Friday. She'd do a problem on the geometry board, and then I'd just do the same problem, and she'd say, "Okay, you're ready to play." Man, that was beautiful. 1.9. But what I'm trying to say is I'm not really the best speller, and so a lot of my stuff will look squiggly. It isn't because I'm fast or like a doctor. It's because I don't really know how to get to the end of that thing, okay? So let's just be square on what's really going down. Appears, the one who appears to have. Yeah, there's a difference, isn't there, between appearing to have something and actually possessing something. Now, I don't think Aristotle really meant it in a, coercive way, like all you got to do is appear. I think he really meant it like the one who appears to have these things, well, then he's going to have it. But for our work, yeah, there's a difference between appearances. In fact, just turn to the letter we're going to be in this week, 2 Timothy. If you wanted a proof text on this, without getting into or ruin anybody's preparation, just turn to 2 Timothy 3, read out loud, one of you to the guy next to you, verses 5 through 9, and you'll see Aristotle's word come back in a ministerial context. Go ahead, one of you read it out loud to the guy next to you. 2 Timothy 3, 5 through 9. Did you all locate the word that mattered? Yeah. They appear to have these things. Yeah. How about you? This is where the rubber hits the floor. How about me? There's another caution in Aristotle's line. The one who appears to possess all these things will, what was the next word? necessarily convinces hearers. That's not true with spiritual things. Spiritual things are spiritually revealed by the Holy Spirit, and you can really have your stuff put together in preaching and it not be effectual in the positive sense of convincing your listener of the truths of the gospel. It doesn't necessarily win. If we spend all our week this time on skills and you go home and go, man, I'm going to nail it now, don't think that you will necessarily convince anyone to become a Christian. You can't do that. That's the role of the Holy Spirit. This is not persuasion in that sense, which is why we don't have to speak in underhanded ways. I can't necessarily make anyone a Christian. So all I'm saying about ethos and my reliance even on the things we're taking from rhetoric and our need to be virtuous in our speech and have goodwill and say the things that are difficult but necessary and to actually make good sense, and I'm constructing sermons that are rational and logical and persuasive and organized, clear, simple, concise, all those things, they don't actually in the end of the day win the day. You know, John Stott was converted under a sermon from Revelation 3 on the church in Ephesus. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone, you know, comes in, I'll come with them. And the guy used that as an evangelistic talk, and Stott was converted. And then later Stott, you know, actually comes, he becomes one of the greatest expositors of the 20th century, and he starts thinking, that's not actually what that text meant at all. So the greatest expositor was converted through a sermon that at some level had inherent deficiency in its accurateness. Guess what? Anything good coming out of your ministry is the same. And in one sense, that ought to free you. Just do the best you can. God takes this stuff. Now, the fact that that happens doesn't mean you should be lazy. You know, devote yourself to these things, 1 Timothy 4. Devote yourself. This is persistent. Persist in these things. But you get what I'm saying. I want to look at a couple of preachers in the Bible that we need to steer clear of on ethos. Let's take a look at Balaam. Turn on back to Numbers 22 through 24. Three of his sermons are in there. He got three oracles going on. And I just want you to see what happens to a guy like Balaam on the matter of ethos. At first glance, he looks like a guy that stays on the line. He looks like an expositor. Sounds like an expositor. And actually, in the inscripturated text, his oracles are the exposition of God's word. In fact, I'll show that to you. Just read with the guy next to you, 23, 11 and 12. And then verses 25 and 26. And then 24, 12 and 13. I've got it written up there. Read those and tell me if you don't think this guy is what we're trying to train here. Go for it. This guy seems like he's a graduate of the Simeon course on biblical exposition. He seems to actually be what we're talking about. I'm going to wait to see what God says, and I'm going to bring that and that alone into today. He's staying on the line. But there are two New Testament writers that interpret those chapters and Numbers differently. And we need to know why. So with the guy next to you, find the two places in the New Testament where the apostolic conclusion is drawn on Balaam's word ministry. And actually see where he messed up. Go for it. The two places in the New Testament that present a picture of an imitation shoe rather than the real deal. I'm sure you all know right where they are. Just announce it to the guy next to you and then go look. You don't need your concordance. Just tell the guy next to you, where does Balaam come in the New Testament? I'm not going to do all the heavy lifting for you. I love watching this. Let's see. I do this for a living now. Where is that? Hey, man, even the writer to the Hebrews said, somewhere it says. Okay, you guys are slowing me down. Look at Jude 11, 2 Peter 2, 15 and 16. There you're going to hear the apostolic conclusion on Balaam. Somebody read Jude 11 for us. Okay, so he groups three Old Testament teachers there. I could explain later how Cain is a teacher, but he takes three Old Testament preachers, Cain, Balaam, and Korah. And they talk about some kind of error. Do you have any context on Jude 11 on what the error might have been? Earlier in Jude, certain people have crept in kind of a licentious way on the gospel. But what about 2 Peter 2, 15 and 16? Somebody read that for us. Nice and loud.
Which have forsaken the right way and are gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Bozor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness.
Love the wages of unrighteousness. So come on back to Numbers, and let's see what these apostles were reading as they looked through Balaam's sermon notes and the narrative on it. There are three subtle times in the Balaam text that I didn't have you look at. First, let me read 22:7. So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the fees for divination in their hands, and they came to Balaam and gave him Balak's message. So they came with money. Now it doesn't say he took it yet. But when you get down to verse 18, Balaam answered and said to the servants of Balak, though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not go beyond the command of the Lord. There's almost a, I know you've got money with you, but you know I don't need that. Then a little later, you know, if he had given me bagfuls of money, I wouldn't be able to do that. Almost like he's upping the ante on his fee base, his honoraria that he was going to require of them. And then you get later in 24, the verse I did have you look at. Again, if Balak should give me his house full of silver and gold. It's just, he keeps bringing money in. And at some point, the New Testament writers actually seem to understand this guy was driven by greed. And he kind of wanted to do the preaching and the playing. In fact, when you get all the way to 25:1, it's really clear. While Israel lived in Shittim, the people began to whore with the daughters of Moab. Balaam begins to allow a licentious living within the church. Sensuality is on the rise. It's okay. God's not going to judge that. He actually now is doing ministry for money. You know, there's a difference between somebody. Some people preach so they can eat. That's Balaam. What you want to be is a guy who eats so he can preach. And you got to stay away from sensuality and greed. You're going to lose your integrity over it. It's going to happen. I'm so glad, you know, Brad, you showed us those books I published. I've kind of been amazed what the Lord's done through those books. Sometimes I think he just has a good laugh, because before I ever published a book, I prayed to the Lord and I decided to actually sign the rights to these things over to the entities for which they had been created, rather than to myself personally, because I was afraid of what I would do with the money, not even knowing that any money would ever come. And now, you know, that little funny little expositional preaching book, I think it's in like 25 languages. The Big Picture Story Bible is in over 30 languages. All these things go out there, and I'm raising 5 kids, and my wife's working full-time so we can send them to college. And sometimes I'm going, man, I really messed up on that thing. But praise be to God, no one ever is going to wonder, why is Helm putting out another book? Well, at least you can go tell him now. He doesn't get a dime from those things. And he wonders if he made the right call. No, he did make the right call. We'll have to talk to Greg Gilbert when he comes up. You ask him what is the gospel is doing. I think Greg's sending all his kids to college on his royalties. Sorry, he had to step out for a phone call. I like swinging at him when he's not in the room. Yeah, the New Testament guys, you don't want to be Balaam. You don't want to be a guy, let me put it this way, what am I saying? You don't want to be a guy who's got all his preaching in order and is disqualified in the faith. And if we've seen anything the last 4 years, that's what we've seen. God has decided to tear it down. And I don't know that he's done. This is probably why Quintilian, then, later than Aristotle, says, I'm proposing to educate the perfect order who cannot exist except in the person of a good man. Love that line. He says, we therefore demand of him not only exceptional powers of speech, but all the virtues of character as well. So here you are, you've come to a whole thing on preaching, and you're like, well, when are we going to get to how we preach better? Yeah, I'll tell you how you preach better. Develop ethos in the preacher. Augustine put it this way, more important than any amount of grandeur of style to those of us who seek to be listened to with obedience is the life of the speaker. A wise and eloquent speaker who lives a wicked life certainly educates many who are eager to learn, although he is useless to his own soul. There was a time my wife and I were invited to this big national event, and it was kind of like a powerhouse roundtable of evangelicalism. I don't know how we got the invitation, but we got the invitation, so I went online and responded, made my reservation online. Yeah, we're going to be there. And so we show up to this thing. I mean, I'm in a suit. My wife's decked out. And we walk up there, and I'm feeling like really good, you know, and you get up to the table, and Dave and Lisa Helm, you know, and all the cards are out, and they're looking around. And you got Dave and Lisa Helm over there? No one had our names anywhere. Meanwhile, all the luminaries are standing around. They're getting their stuff, walking in. Hey, I'll see you in a minute, man. We're going to be in. No. Lady finally looks at me, no lie, says, I am so sorry. We do not have your registration, and every single seat is filled. we turned on our heels. I have never been so embarrassed in my life. It is and will be the most humiliating moment in my life. Well, I pray that it will be. We went out, sat in a restaurant, ordered a bowl of soup, and licked our wounds. I don't know how they lost it. Wasn't our fault, I kept trying to tell Lisa. But imagine this. Preachers showing up at Heaven's Gate. People that you won to Christ. apart. I don't know you. It's happening. It can happen to me. It can happen to you. I don't care about your preaching skills this week. As much as we need to become the men who are ready to preach. What about ethos, not in the life of the preacher, but what about ethos or credibility in the preaching? That's something that's overlooked. You know, you can do things in the preaching that are establishing credibility. Let me give you a few hints on this. One, prepare well. Because if you prepare well, your actual sermon will be clear, simple, rational, reasonable, persuasive. If you don't prepare well, and you've done it, and all of a sudden you're like, man, that thing really could have lit up, but I ended up just preaching a rough draft that wasn't ready for the big house. And man, I wish we had, you know, I wish I was in a church that we had three services. I wish I was like Brad Wheeler. You got like 18 guys running around getting stuff done for you. No, just joking. I love it that all the guys are here. It's what a testament to the Lord's grace and intention. But sometimes I go home and go, man, I wish we had two services. Because then the second service, man, I'd have gotten that thing nailed. And that's the one I would have put up online. But the deal is, it's out the door, baby. It's gone. And sometimes it isn't gone because the things you said weren't good. It just wasn't ready. I didn't prepare well enough. If you prepare well enough, you'll be a preacher that's developing good sense. You'll be leaning more on your reasonableness and the reasonableness of the text and the argument than the passion that you think is what's going to get all the work done. Secondly, avoid stupidity. Sometimes we are so dumb in the pulpit. I was dumb this morning. First thing I did when I came up here after Brad graciously introduced me, I said, well, that was quite an introduction, stole all my time, making this silly joke. And as soon as it said it, it fell flat for you, and you're probably like, why are we listening to this guy? And first thing he does is insult the host. First thing out of his mouth, we got 2.5 days of this guy? That was stupid. We do stupid stuff all the time. You ever get invited to go over to England and preach? Let me tell you, don't bring your American bravado passion with you. Been there, done that. People that found this credible and reasonable and persuasive in that context, over there, they're like, man, he is highly suspect. Because he's trying to pull every emotional string we got. And I had to work really hard to make sure what he was saying was actually true. I'll tell you another one. I went to Canada once. Oh, man, stupid. I get up in there to Canada first time, got like 120 pastors, and I had one Canadian joke that I knew. Anybody from Canada here? Okay, let me tell it to you. Well, you know how they came up with the name Canada and the spelling and all. One guy said to another, well, let's call it Canada. And the guy said, yeah, C-A-N-A-D-A. You know, and how many, they probably heard that 8 million times. And America and Canada, they already feel like they're the brother that's disrespected. And the first thing I do is tell some joke that actually sets my preaching back. Now I really got to overcome that hurdle. In the preaching, avoid stupidity. Ed Copeland, who I work with, pastor at New Zion Baptist Church in Rockford, We train together men for ministry and the word. He says, while each context may require a different part of me, it still should be all of me. So you got to, he's authentic, see. Prepare well, avoid stupidity, avoid overreaching. Don't overplay your hand in your sermons. This can happen when a preacher pretends to know more about something than he really does. I minister now God's humor in the shadow of the University of Chicago, one of the leading institutions in the world. Bright people all the time. I got people walking into my church carrying their Greek, their Hebrew, their Vulgate, their German, their whatever it is. I got people way smarter than me in almost any discipline. And I learned early on not to overplay my hand. You can imagine the humor of God in letting someone like me minister there. But I was tempted early on to say something, you know, by matter of expertise on science or civil religion or the genetic code of whatever it is, you know, and thinking I'm going to connect with you. And all I was doing was setting up hurdles for them because, this dude doesn't have it. He doesn't know what he's talking about. So don't overreach. Your integrity will rise. The minds and hearts of your listeners will be open to you. They don't need to know, in my context, they don't need to know that the pastor is an academic. They need to know that I do the hard work of being a lifelong learner. And when it comes to the handling of the Bible, I can excel them in revealing spiritual truths. That's what they need. So, all those things will help you with good sense to be rational and reasonable. A couple of other things as you begin to develop ethos in the preaching, and that's to bring virtue and goodwill. Let's look at a couple of speeches as you watch how Paul does this and then Moses. Turn over to Acts 20 for a minute. I want you to notice how Paul is establishing credibility with his listener, how he's gaining ethos, that indispensable characteristic of credibility in his preaching message. Acts 20, read verses 18 and 19 out loud with the man next to you, and just ask yourself or answer for yourselves, how did he establish credibility in the preaching? Go for it. Acts 20, 18 and 19. How did he do it? Tell the guy next to you. How did he establish credibility in his introduction? Anybody? What do you got? What did he do?
Through the way he lived.
Yeah, through the way he lived. And he appealed to his life among them. Mm-hmm. Now, he had been in Ephesus for over 3 years, so it was easy for him. But with one sentence, he was able actually to demonstrate virtue. You know I have your best interest at heart. Because you've watched me. You've been with me. He's not putting on anything. So he himself is credible through the appeal to shared life with them. And then look at the very next verse, verse 20. He moves from virtue in 18 and 19 to what I would call goodwill. Like he's not going to withhold what they really need to know. Look what he says. I did not shrink back from declaring to you anything that was profitable and teaching you in public and private from house to house, testifying both to Jews and Greeks of repentance toward God and faith in our Lord Jesus Christ. He's saying, look, not only do you know me, I've been there, you've seen my heart for you, but you also know that I was also willing to share with you the hard things. I didn't shrink back. If it was for your good, you heard it from me. I mean, those are two really wonderful things. You'll recall, according to Aristotle, the quality of goodwill meant that a speaker would not withhold anything from his listener, especially those things that were tough to swallow. And that's what Paul is forcefully doing here. In fact, by the time you get down to verse 27, he says, I gave you the whole counsel of God. I wasn't leaving anything out. So what Paul's words do is they actually, in the preaching, appeal to the listener, shared life, demonstrate virtue and goodwill. Does your preaching do that? Do you ever actually determine I'm going to say these three sentences to draw my listener to me and to my heart in ways that I know are necessary for them to receive the word that I have for them. I mean, remember, the things he's getting ready to tell these guys is, hey, the problems are coming out of this group here. Some of you guys are going to turn. The wolves are going to come in from this, from the people listening to me right now. I mean, well, they were ready to receive that. Sometimes I don't think we do much work on this kind of thing. So he appeals to shared life among them. Here's another one. He actually, in Acts 21, 40 through 22, verse 2, look at another sermon, 40 through 22, verse 2. Read that and tell me, how is he establishing credibility? No, don't tell me. Tell the guy next to you. How did he establish credibility in the preaching? How is he establishing credibility in the preaching? He's approaching them on their level. In what way? How do you know that? What?
Father language.
Okay. Familial language? Yep. 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 So he actually connects in that way. How else?
Culturally.
How? Language. Some of you guys have multiple languages. And when you find yourself in a context, it's really hard for me. I have a very hard time establishing credibility in cross-cultural languages where the actual language is different. So I don't try to employ, hey, let me flip into Hebrew now, or let me go into Spanish or French or Ukrainian or whatever it might be. I can't do that. That's not in me. In fact, if I try that, if I go up to a Latino on Chicago's South Side, and I, you know, me llamo David, the first thing that he's going to do is he's going to say like 18 things real fast, and I'm going to go, no habla español. You have to actually have integrity. But let me put it this way, if you guys have multiple languages, my word, you are at a great advantage for gospel usefulness. I mean, you ought to do it. I went to Africa like 7 times. Every time I had to try to learn Swahili again. But I wasn't trying to learn Swahili. I was trying to learn how to say hi in Swahili. I can't do it. So I took my son over there with me one time, Noah, and I said, now they're going to ask you in church to say something in Swahili. It's a good way, you know, if you're going to preach the word to them, you know, that language, that shared language thing is really important. You know, of course, I couldn't do it. So we get off the plane. I get up there in the church, and every 3 words they have to interpret for me. Noah gets up there. That kid had a dictionary with him on the airplane. He had the verb tenses right. He went on launches out into a Swahili in like 4 paragraphs. I'm sitting there in the front row. The people had seen me come and go, come and go, come and go. The pastor asked him, said, they just applauded, and he could have told them anything he wanted from the Bible, they would have believed it. And he said, who taught you how to speak Swahili? And Noah says, my dad. And the place just burst out because they knew it wasn't your dad. No way. No way. He's got no credibility here on that basis. In fact, once I was walking with my co-pastor, my brother-in-law, and he's really good at this. He's always going into the language, and he's adept at it. And so he's going off onto this other stuff, and I finally look at the guy next to me because John was up there talking to this guy in Swahili, like just nonstop. I said, what is John saying? He goes, I don't know what John's saying. He's thinking he's talking to him in Swahili. That made me feel a little better. But if you have those aptitudes, pray that the Lord would figure out how to use those. We need cross-cultural ministry, cross-language ministry more than ever. But you got to be your own voice, right? So I spend a lot of time in African American context in our country, and I had to learn this too. You know, you you can't be who you aren't. So be who you are, and allow the Lord to fashion you over time. Paul, all I'm trying to say is Paul gained a hearing through the use of shared language. If I spoke Spanish, I would be asking the Lord, how can you increase my ministry through cross-cultural exchange? Well, appeal to shared language. Third, I just want you to see one more from Paul. Look at Acts 26, 1 to 3. Do the same exercise. Acts 26, 1 to 3. How is he in the preaching demonstrating Chuck Taylor-like genuineness and establishing his credibility? Acts 26, 1 to 3. What's he doing? Tell the guy next to you. What do you think he's doing? Anybody? What's he doing? Say that?
Complimenting his audience.
Now, you got to be careful here, right? But it has to be genuine. But that certainly opened the door to be heard, right?
But it's not just flattery. He's pointing to Agrippa's knowledge.
Yeah.
He's not speaking down to.
Yeah. He's actually appealing to the acumen of his audience that's known. Nothing wrong with that. So some of us just get up there and go, all I got to do is preach the Bible. I don't need to do anything that the rhetoricians would say in the sense of trying to get my listener in a good frame of mind. Well, actually, your preaching would be better if your listeners were in a good frame of mind. So you don't have to do a lot. I mean, look at that. It's like three sentences and he's on. But also notice what he's doing. He says there at the end, therefore, what's he say? I beg you to listen to me patiently. He needs him in a good frame of mind because he knows he's got a lot to say today. So you got an especially difficult sermon. How are you going to prepare them to be able to walk with you in it? How are you going to get them to stay with you? I mean, he's just smart here. Let's look at one more thing. Not Paul, but let's look at Moses. Just turn to Deuteronomy 4. Then I'm going to be done. Paul's not the only one you can draw on in their word work in the Bible to see how preachers establish credibility in the preaching. Deuteronomy is basically given to us in the form of three sermons. So these are multiple oral addresses delivered by Moses to Israel, and they're filled with what I'm going to call empathy for his audience. Doggone it. Empathy. Just look at verse, the beginning there, and then I'm going to take you to verse 9. But the beginning, and now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and rules that I'm teaching you and do them that you may live and go and take possession of the land. Notice this little phrase in verse 9. Only take care and keep your soul diligently. Wow, that's the voice of empathy, a pastor for his people. Or you can see it again down in verse 15. Therefore, watch yourselves very carefully. I mean, this is paternal-like preaching. Verse 23, take care. Take care, take care, take care. It keeps coming up in his sermon. Now, I'm highlighting that because Moses had empathy for his listeners. It would have been impossible to hear him without that repeated refrain, take care. And what that repeated refrain did for him was it possessed both virtue and goodwill. I have your best at heart, and I'm willing to share with you what God would have for you. Does your preaching actually do that? Or do you actually walk out of the pulpit and go, man, they better take care? You know, you can only scold your congregation so often. Here is a man who cares for us. Here is a man who has something important to say to us. Here is a man who at the core of his being is communicating God's word to us. We would do well to follow the example of Moses and Paul in their preaching. But let's say you're not any good at this. You're like, man, I can't do the ethos in the preaching thing. Okay. That's all right. Then for you, I've got a couple of thoughts. One is just Dabney, who I quote occasionally, much less so now because of his influence in the Southern Presbyterian world on African-American slavery. But there are things that I'm still have learned from him. He says, the pastor's character speaks more loudly than his tongue. Eloquence may dazzle and please, but holiness of life convinces. Augustine, and I'm done with this. He says to you and to me, if you're not capable of establishing ethos in the preaching, like having sermons that are well-ordered and virtuous and demonstrate goodwill, if you can't do that, he says you should seek to live in such a way that not only gains a reward for himself, but also gives an example to others. Here it is, so that his way of life becomes, in a sense, an abundant source of eloquence. Isn't that great? Back to the first part. Back to part one of this talk. Your own life can be an abundant source of eloquence. So develop credibility in the preacher. Develop credibility in your preaching. And you will be able to move more persuasively and genuinely from text to today.